thank you for stopping by Red Ice Radio. The websites are redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. We are currently enjoying the fine honor of censorship. Radio 314 most recently taken down from iTunes. Check the latest video on the websites. Red Ice Radio was censored in November of last year, 2014. It's a brave new era of thought control or opinion police. Politically correct tyrannies are rising up everywhere. So speak up, break the spell, and dispel the mythmakers. The time to speak up is now, or forever be silent and let your children be the victim of a future that in all likelihood will chemically lobotomize all those who have the, quote, wrong opinions, unquote. So don't let them be victims of your inaction. I think you know what the right thing is. You see what is wrong in the world and the injustices that rule us and the falsehood that is spreading everywhere. So time to speak up, rise up, and not to be shut down by words and intimidation and such nonsense. So we say thank you for your support, and thank you for helping to get the word out about our programs as well. We have Daniel Spaulding with us. He earned a Bachelor's of Arts in English Literature from Bridgewater State University. He currently works and lives in Seoul, South Korea. He enjoys reading philosophy, history, politics, and science fiction. Among the writers he enjoys are included Joseph Piper, Seraphim Rose, Oswald Spengler, C.S. Lewis, Vladimir Soloviev, and Nicholas Berdyaev. Well, stay with us. We're going to have an interesting discussion today about both the Occident and the Orient. Let's get moving. Well, thank you for joining us today, Daniel. It's great to speak with you. We, of course, or I spoke with our mutual friend Jay Dyer here a while back, so we're glad to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You bet. So tell us first here, when did you end up writing for, well, not only Soul of the East, you write for a number of websites out there, a number of outlets that pick up and publish some of your work, but what got you into these topics and these areas, Daniel?
I'm trying to recall the dates, but I think my first articles maybe appeared last year. It's 2014. I was kind of badgered into writing by Mark Hackard, my friend Mark Hackard, who is the editor of Soul of the East, and also Colin Liddell over at Alternative Right. Pressed me on multiple occasions to write, so I finally gave in to them and started writing. I'd been kind of a observer of that scene for a while, these different websites, reading them and commenting on them and such, and they thought I had some interesting things to say and pushed me to do some formal writing.
There you go. So they knew about your skills in some way beforehand, I guess, huh?
I guess so. I was a little surprised. I've never thought of myself as a good writer or anything of that nature. So it was, good thing to try and start doing for me.
There you go. So how long have you been into some of the subjects here before you began writing? A couple of years, you said? More than that?
Yeah, several years. But mostly just reading and, the occasional comment on different, websites, comment sections and things of that nature. So last year's when I actually started writing, actual articles that got published on these websites.
Well, it's a good step. We need more people to get involved in whatever way they can, be that from, writing or being, part of the foot soldiers out there on the ground, if you will, whatever people can do, right? We need to get it out there and start getting involved, right?
Yeah. People, need to be proactive. And if you have, believe these things, try to say so, do something. There's certainly a large audience out there who wants, new ideas, fresh ideas, and not just the kind of same old stale stuff that most people are exposed to.
Exactly. And before getting to some of the kind of main topics we want to address here today, and we have a lot of them, there certainly isn't any lack of issues to discuss, but maybe you can tell us how you ended up in Seoul, in Korea, and what your view of things of the West, of the decay of the West is from over there.
I ended up here as an English teacher. I wasn't having good job prospects back home, so I came over here, had a little adventure. you know, I like it over here. You know, being a sort of a foreigner, you know, gives you some different, you know, perspectives on the world and on society and such. But, you know, as looking back, you know, obviously I haven't been back to America now for over a year. I've been here 2 years. But, you know, seeing, you know, so most of my interaction with the West is what I see in the news now. And sadly, a lot of times, you know, looking back, especially in the United States, seeing what happens, you know, it looks like a basket case half the time. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's I think it's pretty much correct. It's,
yeah.
It's going down the drain and really quick,
yeah.
I'm afraid.
Yeah. On all, you know, on all levels, you know, both, you know, culturally as well as its foreign policy and all of these kinds of things. It's just, you know, it just looks like an absurdity.
Well, it is, and it's remarkable how some of these things that we've seen in the last few years have really kicked off and really fast. I know that you've written about ISIS a little bit, for example, and it's
yes.
fascinating to see how one of these organizations that were largely unknown has risen to this international status of seemingly superhuman abilities have arisen out of nowhere. It's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Yes, exactly, you know, and... I'm one of those, though, of the, you know, from what I've been able to see, you know, I'm of the opinion that, you know, certainly when it comes to ISIS, for example, that they've had certain outside influences who have wanted to see their rise, though, you know, who've wanted to see them succeed to some extent there.
Well, certainly, exactly. They've been helped along in many
yeah.
aspects. They've also actually been several times now there have been claims of some of their arms, some of their resources being basically helped along with by the U.S. They even found logos of USAID on some of the recent they're dropping resources to them, basically, to make sure that they can thrive and prosper in the region, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. You know, there's, I think it was maybe two or three weeks ago, the Iraqi government of all, you know, of all people accused the U.S. and I think the U.K. of deliberately dropping arms, airdropping arms into ISIS-held territory. We've seen multiple stories of that happening, you know, over the past year or so. And, you know, and every time we're told, oops, it was an accident, you know, but it seems to happen, you know, often enough that, you know, you kind of have to start wondering, you know, how does this type of accident keep happening? And I think also it was in the New York Times, I think again last week, that they had a story about all this U.S. money into Afghanistan that was going to Al-Qaeda and to the Taliban there. You know, supposedly the U.S. is fighting against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, yet supplying, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars you know, again, supposedly by accident, but I don't know how these kind of accidents keep happening on such a regular basis. It's, you know, mind-blowing.
Yeah, it surely is. So what's the bigger view you think that we need to take here to understand some of the things that we see in the Middle East, if we look at that first? Because it's a big picture, and we have a lot of different players in it, of course. But how do you view this?
Well, I mean, for ISIS, for instance, that was, you know, to take down Bashar Assad, I think, you know, he's, you know, the U.S. wants him gone. They've made that clear. NATO wants him gone. The Saudis want him gone, et cetera. Turkey, Israel, they all want him gone. But, you know, in the U.S., for instance, there's not much appetite for a war against Assad. You may recall, I think it was 2013, October, September, somewhere around then, in 2013, there was this claim that Assad used chemical weapons or something like that.
Yep, yep.
And they initially tried to use that to sort of hype up a war against Assad, but there was no, in Europe and in North America, there was no appetite for it. So they had to, you know, put that on the back burner. But they've been funding these rebels, telling us, no, they're moderates, they're Democrats, all the while, you know, report after report shows, you know, them burning down churches. You know, you may remember the one guy, the rebel commander, who was eating the organs of one of, you know, a dead Syrian soldier.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, committing all kinds of atrocities and finally exposed, you know, as these, you know, vicious religious fanatics, these Wahhabists and such. They use these rebels, which many later became what we now call ISIS, to, you know, try to get rid of Assad, and it hasn't worked. It's kind of fought to a standstill. And then ISIS started turning east to Iraq, started challenging the U.S.'s Kurdish allies, and that's when all of a sudden ISIS became a problem, when they started stepping on the wrong toes. Because prior to that, you know, Obama was just dismissing them as, what did he call them, like the varsity league and all of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, they were just, you know, dismissed, and all of a sudden, you know, they start challenging, you know, the Kurds, who are, you know, close allies of the U.S. government in the region. You know, that's when all of a sudden, oh, we got to do something about this. And then we saw the kind of hysteria in the, you know, the media. Oh, ISIS is coming across the Mexican border. Oh, ISIS is here. ISIS is there. And, you know, and all of it was, you know, kind of unsubstantiated, ridiculous nonsense. But now they've, you know, Obama and the, you know, the War Party, as they're often called now, you know, are able to get their foot in the door, and they're trying to expand the war now. Ultimately, they still want to get Assad. I'm not sure, you know, how they'll be able to go about doing it at this point. You know, there's mixed feelings about what to do. So I don't know. Let's kind of wait and see where they go with it. But, you know, this long history of using these, you know, radical Muslim groups, starting as early, you know, as the under the Carter administration, they started using them in Afghanistan, and this is just a continuation of that long policy, you know, that 3 decades now of using these in against, you know, regimes that they don't like, against geopolitical enemies. You know, it's just part of that same long game.
Yeah, the base, yeah. Or whatever they call them initially, Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. Al-Qaeda, who was a Brzezinski and these guys who started kick that all off back in the late 70s there.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that they will try to use them in whatever way they can, and what was surprising to me as well is that the media campaigns in the West have been so successful, in fact, that we've had a surprising amount of immigrants in Europe, for example, that actually goes and joins ISIS and fights for them. Gothenburg in Sweden was one of these cities that had more amount of fighters joined from Gothenburg, Sweden, than all of America, which is quite interesting, you know?
Yeah, well, I saw one graph or chart recently, you know, that was showing the different foreign contributions of fighters to ISIS, you know, and a large portion, you know, from Britain and France, I believe. You know, even more, you know, Britain and France are, you know, contributing more fighters than certain Arab countries are. You know?
Exactly.
which is, you know, eye-opening, but nobody has any kind of thought to, you know, what to do about that or why is that happening. It's just, you know, kind of, oh, we'll arrest them if they come back, you know, these kind of reactive solutions, you know, so-called solutions, but nobody's asking, you know, on a fundamental level, why is this happening? You know, why are so many young men, young Muslim men from Britain, from France, from Sweden, and even increasingly from the United States, why are so many of these young Muslim men going to places like Syria and Somalia, et cetera, to do this kind of thing?
Well, exactly. Do you think their reaction is, I mean, there's a two-pronged issue here, and one is, of course, that they've been uprooted themselves, and when that occurs, you do try to find something which is a vestige of your own culture, an identifying marker, if you will, and you kind of cling on to that. So on one hand, I understand it, but at the same time, if we look at what has happened in the Middle East and some of the countries, is their actions justifiable, although they might go to an organization that at the top might be controlled?
It's kind of a complex, you know, if we want to think about it in terms of like is it morally justified or something like that? It's kind of a complex issue. I agree with you there that, you know, there's this kind of cultural or social alienation on the part of young Muslims living in the West. You know, they're in a culture, in a civilization that's not their own. And they're from their own, you know, a completely separate civilization. You know, Islam is not merely a religion. It's also this, you know, has this entire historical civilization. And to sort of just be ripped out of that and put somewhere else, I mean, that is, I would imagine, a very alienating experience.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, again, just commenting it from not making any judgment one way or the other, just looking at it, you know, I suppose from a sociological standpoint or what have you, that, you know, it's alienating experience and, you know, grasping, you know, in the West, for instance, you know, even Native Westerners are now being are starting to be denied their identity. So imagine
Absolutely.
If you're coming from somewhere else, just thrown in this sort of multicultural hodgepodge where, you know, you can only have this kind of cosplay identity, you know, this kind of safe dress-up identity, and anything beyond that is not really smiled upon. So, you know, it's this alienating experience, and you don't fit in, you don't feel any connection to where you are, what's going on around you, and just believing in so-called Western values or democratic values just doesn't cut it ultimately.
No.
So yeah, I think they're going off. And on the other hand, I think, I don't know, it's attributed to bin Laden, but he said something to the extent, you know, that in a race between two horses, you know, people naturally want to back the stronger horse. And, you know, young Muslims, these alienated young Muslims, seeing a group like ISIS being so successful, being, you know, just taking over town after town in Syria and Iraq, and they look at that and they see, well, these guys, you know, they've got something going on. They have, you know, this is the real deal, and I want to be part of that.
Right.
You know, yeah. It's, you know, I don't want to just be sitting at home playing my Xbox and eating, you know, McDonald's. That's not enough for me. You know, I want to be part of something, you know, because most people, you know, a lot of people want to be part of something larger than themselves. You know, they don't just want to be this kind of free-floating atom who doesn't have anything more than just your personal, you know, self-gratification. You know, they want something more than that, and that ISIS gives them that avenue. And it plays, you know, to their, you know, this kind of resentment. You know, I think there's a kind of resentment because a lot of Muslims fall in this kind of underclass category, especially in parts of Europe. And that kind of breeds a certain resentment, and they see, oh, ISIS is taking on, supposedly, you know, quote unquote, taking on the West or taking on the infidels. And we, you know, they make us feel like we have some power. They make us feel like we, you know, have something going for us.
Right. Exactly. And I think there are multiple agendas being fulfilled with this. I've mentioned it many times on the program,
exactly.
But, you know,
yeah.
I wonder if those who have caused the scenario that we now see of mass immigration and what have you are truly so stupid that they would not see that this would eventually happen. Surely they have a better understanding of human psychology than to play innocent in a part like this, right?
Oh, I agree. I think, and I've written about this in some of my articles, you know, I think they benefit from this sort of insecurity this situation creates. The insecurity, the sort of, I mean, now in both North America and in Europe, you have these situations where these kind of, you know, so-called lone wolves just, you know, come out of nowhere and assassinate people or try to assassinate, you know, non-Muslim, you know, police or, you know, run people out with cars and those kind of things, or beheadings in the street, like we saw in Britain a few years back with, what was it, Lee Rigby.
Yep.
This kind of stuff, this kind of, you know, spontaneous or seemingly spontaneous stuff, the insecurity of this nature, they benefit the elites, the power structure, they benefit from it. It doesn't challenge their power ultimately. They're not endangered from it, you know, and it allows them to expand their surveillance states, expand their police state. They can use these incidents to hype up their, you know, certain aggressive foreign policy actions that they want to take. So it doesn't harm them ultimately. Yeah, it might be a nuisance, but they can turn it around to their benefit, and they know this. You know, they're not worried about it. They're not losing sleep over it. It's, you know, the people, you know, the normal people on the street may be, you know, threatened by it to some extent. But yeah, those who have the power, it's not a threat to them. Indeed, it's a benefit to them ultimately, in that they can use it to expand their power base.
Do you think we'll see more of these kinds of reactions in the future? Not just from Muslims in the West, but also by Europeans in the West, a reaction to kind of what has been given to us, a way of life. It's very atheistic. It's very materialistic. It's an empty existence that is predicated on materialism and consumerism.
Well, I mean, like I mentioned earlier, people look ultimately for something larger than you know what they have right before them. You know, not all people, but enough people do that. You know, right now we see it more so obviously with the Muslims because they have more, I guess, access to different avenues of that sort. As far as Europeans and North Americans, I think, you know, sadly, I think we do put up with a lot more than other people do.
yeah.
I don't, you know, the sort of social engineering that we have in our countries is, you know, you have to hand it to the social engineers. They're very good at what they do, in terms of keeping their, populations pacified and distracted. But I know I'm not a total pessimist. I think ultimately these things can only go so far. And, you know, if you push people far enough, ultimately, you know, they're going to push back. What forms those are going to take in the future, I don't know. But certainly, I mean, you can see the stage being set for a certain social unrest in the next few years. Things don't change. I'm looking at economic factors, demographic factors. You know, these things are, you know, gonna start producing, you know, the negative consequences that are inherent.
Yep, exactly. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, you wrote a really good article, and I think this is kind of related in a roundabout way. It's really, you know, questioning our own system of values, where we are headed, some of the bigger questions in life, or striving for more, I guess. You wrote a piece over at Alternative Right on the movie Edge of Tomorrow, and something that's called the Eternal Return, or the Eternal Recurrence, about you know, Nietzsche's philosophies, you know, kind of adapting or striving for something higher, becoming an Übermensch. This is something that's, I feel anyway, Daniel, has been tremendously misunderstood in our society today. It's almost like we look down on things today, at least in the West, of things that has to do with improvement. It's like, you know, it's anti-intellectualism is very popular, of course, and trying to, you know, not striving for more has become kind of a virtue, if you will. But have you been interested in Nietzsche for many years, or how, when did your interest in him start?
Oh, actually, when I was a teenager, I came across some of his books. You know, I was, I don't know, maybe 14 or 15 years old. And I've always had a kind of a different relationship with Nietzsche. I'm a Christian, so obviously, you know, that puts one in a weird, but I appreciate him very much. You know, I find he has a lot to say. You know, I'm not going to claim I take him wholesale, obviously, but I find he has a lot to say. He clarifies a lot of things, and I think especially Christians need to read him to sort of, you know, challenge some of the things that they hold, you know, or they think they believe or hold dear. But anyways, yeah, so I discovered him when I was a teenager. I think the first book I read from him, oddly enough, was his book Antichrist. which, you know, coming from a Christian background, that word has a certain connotation, attached
sure has.
To it.
Yeah.
But you know, he meant something very different by it. But so that you know where my interest in him goes. But you know, using him to come back to what you were just talking about is one thing I picked up from Nietzsche is this idea of resentment. The lower resenting the higher. And seeing this, play out in sort of multiple groups that we see now in, on the political and social stage in the West, the feminists, the so-called social justice warriors, the sort of the racial racketeers and all of these different groups, just driven by pure resentment, this deep resentment that they have having read Nietzsche, that gives me some insight on that, or his ability to see stuff like that, the resentment, the will to power by these resentful groups that, yes, they try to mask what they're doing behind this kind of flowery rhetoric, oh, we just want equality, we just want justice, or these kinds of things, but it's just, kind of a veneer for their own will to power. They envy the power that this other group, whether it's this imaginary patriarchy or whoever,
yep.
whoever has, holds this power, they envy that power and they wish to, acquire that power. But they hide it behind, this, like I said, this rhetoric about human rights or equality and, and having read, parts of Nietzsche, it sort of gives you the ability to kind of gain some perspective on some of this stuff going on around us.
Well, I wanted to ask you about how you view that. I guess to a certain extent a contradiction within it, I guess, because you spoke earlier, for example, about when something is viewed as being strong or having some of this power. I do think it's true that some cultures, some people are more prone to be attracted to that because they want that power and they therefore align themselves with it. In this case, very strange, and we can discuss how this might have happened too, but I feel anyway, in the West now, we've had kind of a transvaluation of these values where we now kind of root for the underdog, right? We look at the victim class, and that's to a certain extent what many of these social justice warriors do. They look at those who lack the power and try to align themselves with them and say, we are the outsider. Let's topple the power so that we can become it, of course. But it's an interesting switch that has occurred in my view, where we no longer kind of stand ourselves in the West behind the king and say, yes, here is a good leader. Let's get some stuff done here. It's all about, it becomes a kind of a king of the hill type of power trip for a lot of people, right?
Yeah. I think it goes beyond this kind, as kids, as children, we are always taught, to value the underdog, but it's gone, I think, beyond that, because, I certainly don't like to see, somebody who's defenseless to be bullied or, to be mistreated. I don't care for that.
Sure.
I don't like injustice. I think most people would have that now, but it's gone beyond that into this sort of celebration of the ugly, of the freakish, of the, and this kind of hatred of the beautiful, hatred of the good, hatred of the, kind of thing. It's this resentment that, and again, I think there's, other factors, obviously, there are, speaking of sort of historical injustices that these things, sort of try to take advantage of and spin out of, wildly out of proportion and stuff and use. Again, this is, like I said, what I learned. One thing I learned from Nietzsche is this will to power. And, usually when we hear will to power, we think of, this kind of fascist rising up to take power. But, Nietzsche talks about, the resentful people, the people of resentment and their will to power and how they, like you talked about, the transvaluation and all this kind of stuff that that they use to do that.
Wouldn't you say that instead of, let's say, striving, because I think that this was more common in the past, Daniel, that instead of striving towards becoming that which is greater, for example, by, adopting this, let's say, as a role model instead of this, those who resent, they see this as no longer something to strive for, but an enemy, something to detopple. And that's something which is fairly new, I feel. It's not something that is ancient, if you will, within European tradition. We used to align ourselves, as I said, with the king, but we no longer do that, right?
No, and if you look at it from a sort of traditional perspective, it used to be that you wanted to ascend, you wanted to go to a higher level. But now the situation is descending, to pull down what is good down to the level of the bad, to pull down what is beautiful to the level of the ugly, you know, instead of trying to rise above the lower situation to something higher, to transcend. Now it's about descending, and not just descending, but pulling everyone else down with you.
Exactly. Yep. Crab mentality, as we call it. Yeah. No one can get out of the bucket, right?
Yeah. Exactly. You know, and you see it all the time. You know, if there's this new situation, you know, what do they call it, fat shaming and these types of things, and big is beautiful and all these kinds of things that, you know, are just jealousy and resentment against people who are beautiful. You know, not everybody is beautiful. That's that, you know, nature is not egalitarian. Not everybody is going to be strong. And that's just the fact of the universe.
That's right.
Instead of recognizing that and trying to be the best that you can and do the best that you can, you try to tear down those who are better than you in some way and bring them down to your level. And that's at least my observation.
Oh, yeah.
Observation of these trends.
I completely agree with you. It's very unfortunate. I think it's also pitted everyone against everyone, pretty much. That's a classic divide and conquer strategy, where we now within the West have become so busy by examining each other and looking at what, you know, this group has versus that group, and while this has been happening internally. Those around us have kind of been closing in, if you will. But how would you say that the concept of the Übermensch, the overman, kind of position itself along something like this that we just have been talking about? What is the Übermensch?
There's a lot of, I'm not a Nietzsche scholar, so I know there's a lot of different academic debates in terms of what exactly he meant. But I always took away from that was, you know, this notion of self-overcoming. Nietzsche spoke a lot about that, you know, and I often translate the word as what the overman, you know, which in English kind of doesn't make a lot of sense if you don't understand his, you know, the concept of self-overcoming. And certainly, like, Nietzsche had a very, I don't know what you might call, spiritual side to him. I mean, he wasn't obviously a traditional religious believer
sure,
by any means.
Of course not.
But he wasn't your Dawkins atheist, you know, who just believes in, you know, the supremacy of science and just believe in science and just believe what, you know, a few scientists aligned with the White House tell you to believe. Rather, you know, he saw, you know, he had a much more deep and fascinating view on humanity. But he saw that man could be more than he was.
I agree with you. Let me just interject quickly.
Of course.
I'm not a Nietzschean scholar either, but I've always felt that he kind of embodied some kind of a spirit, which is something European, I guess, for the lack of a better term. I can't really put my finger on it, but something which is more eternal, something which is part of that striving of something which is a value which we have lost. Would you agree?
Exactly. Yes, totally. And again, like I said, I'm not obviously a Nietzschean, being a Christian and whatnot, but I certainly think he gives us a lot, you know, he illuminates a lot of truths for us. And he brings certain things, you know, to the forefront that maybe a lot of people have missed over the past few centuries. And certainly he I think was prophetic in some sense, you know, in terms of understanding our current situation and where it was going. For example, I have very much been able to benefit from his idea of the so-called last man that he talks about in his book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, that he describes, you know, the situation of the last man, which this, you know, perfectly describes the situation we find ourselves now in the modern West, you know, that, you know, the last man, he just wants comfort. He just wants, he doesn't want anything that challenges him, that, you know, he doesn't want any, he's risk averse. He's, he's a creature of comfort and easily subdued and easily manipulated by those above him. And I think that's, you know, he was on to something there with that.
Yeah, it sure is happening right in front of us. It's pretty interesting. Yeah, it was a while ago you wrote the piece on The Edge of Tomorrow, the movie, where you brought up some of Nietzsche's work, you know, and that's why I brought him up to you. But do you recall anything of the eternal recurrence and some of those themes there? I think it's I guess it's more about the idea of seeing things cyclical than linear, right?
Yes, and also, you know, it plays into this idea that he had about the love of one's fate. So he talked about, you know, I'm trying to recall the exact story. It's been a little bit while since I've read it, but you know, if there's a man who a demon comes up to him and whispers, you know, what if I told you that not only will you live this life, but you'll live it again and again and again, you know, in an eternal number of times, the same life, the same choices, you know, how would you respond to that? How would you, you know, what would you, would that just fill you with utter dread and despair and, you know, things of that nature, or on the contrary, would it cause you to embrace your fate, to love your fate, and, you know, how would you respond? And he puts that sort of scenario before us, and I think that's, you know, I think we do have, as it were, our fates. I don't think necessarily that I'll live this life over again and again and again, but, you know, the literal aspect of it isn't important. It's sort of the I guess if we can use the spiritual or philosophical element that's more important here. It's how does one, you know, what attitude does one take towards one's fate, one's life? Does one just look at one's life and look at its seeming futility and, you know, just say, you know, fall into some deep despair, like some of the existentialists did? Or does one, you know, just go and embrace it and this kind of, you know, this life-affirming notions that Nietzsche talks about?
Yeah, it's very interesting because that's, of course, at the same time that we embrace that fate, that's when we also actually can do something with it, as opposed to just kind of being a victim of it, that we, to a certain extent, deal with the cards, if you will, that we've been dealt and try to do the best of the situation. Because everything, if you think about it, everything of that philosophy, of that outlook on life is changed within society today. We think that whatever happens to you, even depending on physical disabilities or what have you, that you are somehow granted by some unseen force to have the exact same experience as everyone else, right? The nature of egalitarianism.
Yes, yeah, because that's the thing is this love of one's fate, you know, it creates this notion that this is my life, it has value, it has, there's something more to it than just, you know, I can have something more to it than just being like everybody else, just being, you know, part of the blob, you know, part of the Borg hive mind, you know, I can, you know, it's, which is what egalitarians offer us, what the technocrats offer us. Just, you're just part of the blob. You're just part of the Borg hive, you know, whereas, the thinkers I like Nietzsche, like Kierkegaard, like Berdyaev, they offer us something quite, you know, different from that.
They absolutely do. By the way, we can Let's talk a little bit about your, I think it's your latest piece called Individualism versus Personality, where you also kind of, you go into that a little bit of the kind of the false dichotomy that we're faced with now in terms of, you know, collectivism versus individualism, and that this is kind of like, this is the only options that we have these days. And I too very much feel that it's kind of based on a false, polarized issue where I think we need to transcend beyond both of these, actually.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I mean, there is some element of truth to it, but you know, we expect. I don't know how much this dichotomy, this dialectic, is presented in Europe, but in North America, especially the United States, you know, we have these large libertarian circles, and I was for a time influenced by those. So certainly, I'm familiar with the rhetoric that they. That they have, and they give us all the time this, oh, collectivism versus individualism, and their notion of collectivism, you know, depending on who you ask, you know, collectivism is either exclusively just, you know, the state, whether it's fascism or communism or even, you know, the modern liberal managerial state, or some of the more radical left libertarians will include things like the church, like the family, you know, the traditional family, and these things as, you know, collectivist units that keep us down, that suppress us.
Right.
And there's then there's the individual. But their notion of the individual, I mean, this is not the sort of the heroic individualism of Nietzsche. This is the, you know, kind of egalitarian, consumerist individual.
Exactly.
I'm an individual because, so that means I can dye my hair however I want and nobody can tell me, you know,
right.
Or I can, you know, I can, get all these tattoos and nobody can tell me that, or, you know, just this kind of very banal, you know, things that, you know, don't really, have any higher meaning to them. Or, you know, I'm an individual, so I can spend my money however, you know, it's these kind of purely, purely on the material level.
Right.
They never go beyond that. And also it's very disconnecting. I'm just this kind of free floating atom, you know, floating around in society, not connected with my family, not connected with my ethnic or racial heritage, not connected with my religious heritage, not connected with any of this. I'm just kind of this, I don't know, almost a nothing sometimes it seems.
No belonging, and, no bigger.
Yeah, you're not rooted in anything. You're not attached to anything, and certainly not to anything higher, much less anything on a horizontal level.
Yeah.
And I think I quoted in my article, I quoted René Guénon, the French metaphysician, the traditionalist metaphysician, and even he talks about this kind of individualism, which doesn't seek to bring man higher, but just keeps him on this purely horizontal level, and doesn't, you know, it's nothing, he's not, man is not made any the better for it. And on the contrary, you know, this Berdyaev in his book, which I had recently read, Solitude and Society, and in contrast, he proposes something else called what he calls the personality, which is this much more holistic view of man, and it's not just something granted. You know, it's something man has to aspire to and develop. But it looks at man as not just a body, but as, you know, body, soul, and spirit, which is sort of the traditional view of man, you know, that he's not just a body, he's not just a soul, he's not just spirit, but he's all of this together, and that man has to be evaluated in his, that, you know, in person, and it's the personalism of Berdyaev, you know, he talks about that man has to be evaluated, not, you know, on several levels, not just the biological or naturalistic level, but also social and spiritual, and, you know, going up this sort of chain of being, if you will.
A holistic approach, in other words.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And this is what I always feel has always been lacking. Wherever you go, it's always, you know, this, that, or the other, but never all the different things together. If we speak for a moment a little bit more about individualism and this as a, well, I would say a distinct Western trait as we see it. We've taken a different path than many other cultures. Do you think that this has been part of our downfall, that we've moved in this direction, which although, as you said before, has a very, I think, virtuous quality when we look at it from the Nietzschean perspective, that, you know, as the one man, you can rise against a tide, you can change things. It's, again, it's a kind of a reminiscent of the aspect of a king or like a righteous leader or something like that. But at the same time, it's caused tremendous amount of problems for it too, hasn't it?
It certainly is sort of a double-edged sword. I think, some of the, like Berdyaev and some of the different philosophers I read, you know, they do say something specifically inherent to the West and trace it all the way back to the Greeks even, elements of it in Greek philosophy and that, and then through Christianity and into modernity. And I think, you know, if we speak about individualism, certainly there is certain, that's why I say call it a double-edged sword. Certainly there's some positive, there are many positive aspects to it. But, I mean, especially in our age where, you know, to be, you know, the age of the mass, you know, mass society, you know, some notion of the individual is important to keep in mind so that you're not just absorbed into the mass. But at the same time, when it's just this completely secularized, desacralized, notion that's not connected or rooted to anything else, it's ultimately can be destructive. It's socially destructive, and we see that happening around us.
Yeah, we don't. Many people, I'd say, don't recognize that. We don't understand why are there so many problems? Why are people unhappy? Why are they on, you know, these SSRI pills, and why they're overeating? Why are they drinking so much? Well, you know, there's all these issues, and yet, despite this, it feels to me, anyway, that some of the answers are quite obvious, because we refuse to look backward. We're always pushing forward. Progress is never looking back to a certain extent, and that is part of our downfall. We don't recognize that we're part of a collective soul, if you will, of a people that has a history and tradition. And when we turn our back towards those things, we're on thin ice, for the lack of a better term, right?
Oh yeah, we're lost for sure. You know, because we assume that we know better than those who came before us. You know, and that's the progressive trope. You know, we're given in history books, for instance, the Dark Ages, which weren't really that that dark. If you go back and look, those before us, they were all just superstitious, witch burning, crazy people. You know,
right.
There's nothing of redeemable value in what they experienced, what they knew, what they did. On the other hand, we moderns, we know best. You know, we're the most evolved. We're the most, you know, evolved culturally speaking, civil, you know, socially speaking. We're, you know, we've got it right, and we're on the right track. And this kind of hubris and no sense of the tragic at all. You know, in the modern liberal thought, there's no sense of the tragic at all. And so they're completely and willingly oblivious to any of the inherited wisdom, inherited tradition that, you know, our ancestors, you know, gave us, you know, which is of infinite value, but, you know, nobody wants to take it seriously because, you know, this arrogance, this hubris that modernity carries within it.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like with enough redistribution of wealth and the same level of education, we'll be able to save man from their original sin, right?
yeah, exactly. It's just everything. And that's the thing, there's a certain spiritual unawareness, so it's all just reduced to these purely material and social things. So if we just throw enough money or do enough social engineering, that will fix it in the end.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't fix what you don't understand. And
that's right. Yeah.
That's what it ultimately, and again, I don't know how much of it isn't ever intended to be fixed. How much of it is just, stage play for the masses, you know. Yeah, your situation's bad, but we'll fix it one day, you know, just to keep them pacified and feed them false hopes. You know, again, how much of it is even sincere in the first place, I don't know.
Do you think that this is a plot to disconnect people from their past, to make them, to a certain extent, more easily controllable, or is it something that we brought upon ourselves inadvertently, perhaps?
I'm of an opinion that's kind of a mix of both. Certainly there are those who say so themselves. If you look at, you know, Brzezinski and Russell and all these different technocrats and stuff, they make very clear that they want social engineering, that they want to have controlled populations and all this sort of stuff. But at the same time, I think, you know, if we just look at history, civilizations and cultures in their later stages, you know, this is the sort of thing that happens. This sort of, if you come back before, you know, this sort of cyclical history of, you know, of a civilization that, you know, if you look at Plato or Spengler, that they would talk about stuff like that. You know, that civilizations go through cycles and towards the end of the cycle, you know, that's, you know, the worst stage, if you will, to what some of the traditionalists borrowing from the Hindus call the Kali Yuga, and this sort of, you know, where it's just pure decline, pure degeneration, and it just has to pass through that stage. There's not, you know, and ultimately that stage will come crashing down, but it still has to go through it. So, again, I think certainly, obviously, a lot of it is that we see is a result of manipulations and scheming and stuff of that nature, but some of it's just the natural cycle of civilization.
Yeah, we've spoken a lot about the different ages of the over the Kali, the different ages and the different aspect of we've moved from the gold, if you will, into a lower base metal, if you will, and it's it's very interesting to view it that way actually, because I think there's a lot of truth to that. We seem to rise and fall, and it seems to be tied to a cycle which is to a certain extent kind of beyond our own collective ability to change it, that we kind of almost suffer from it to a certain degree. But you know what? We can continue and talk a little bit more about that in the second segment. This first one just flew by here. But why don't we talk a little bit more about some of the places where you write for, Daniel? And okay. Of course, I don't know. Do you have any of your own websites out there so far? Maybe some other details you can give out for people who want to follow your writing more closely?
Well, obviously, most of my original writing appears now on Soul of the East. You can always find it there. Usually once or twice a month, I'll have something new there. And there's a couple sites that will, you know, I want to thank them for. They will republish my articles. Colin at Alternative Right, he often republishes my articles. 21st Century Wire will republish my articles, another good site. I think Patrick Hennington over there. And Jay Dyer, a good friend of mine, he also will put on his site Jay's Analysis, which is another good site, and a mutual friend of ours. He also promotes my work. So check out, if your viewers want, they can check out any of those sites.
All right, very good. We'll have these.
Follow, yeah.
Exactly. We'll have these linked up here, souloftheeast.com. Do you have a Twitter or something like that you want to give out?
I don't really. I have, but I don't.
What?
Really?
Are you not on Twitter?
Often.
My God.
I'm on it. I'm on it, but I don't. I don't. I usually just read more than post anything. I don't. Yeah.
180 characters, is it, right?
Yeah. I never really got the Twitter down yet. So.
It's new times, that's for sure. If you can't say it in 180, you're out.
I think George Orwell would appreciate that.
Exactly, there you go.
I think in terms of writing, I think I remember reading George Orwell's essay, was it on politics in the English language, and he talks about, you know, try to use as few words as you can to say what you mean, you know, so maybe Twitter can help people do that. So instead of giving us this sort of long-winded stuff that we get a lot from the leftist media. So.
Exactly. Double plus good, as we say.
All
right. Well, we'll take a short break here. And ladies and gentlemen, again, the websites will be linked up those that Daniel mentioned, so make sure to click through to some of these sites that he mentioned there. But yeah, we'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with more. We'll speak more with Daniel Spaulding in our members segment next up here. We have another hour as we continue our conversation about the controllers, the social engineering, doublespeak, the changing of the language and definition of words. We talk about the destruction of diversity and rise of monoculture and the science of controlling people, to name a few of the topics we'll get into in the next segment. You can sign up and get full access to all our programs, videos, all Radio 314 shows, and all the other material we have there for you. We do not have any commercial interruptions or website ads. If you like what we do, sign up and stream or download any of our programs in full. We have tons of shows for you. You can get them directly to your iPhone, iPad, Android, Kindle, or pretty much whatever else you are using by subscribing to the RSS feeds, the podcast feed, with a podcast app. We have all the instructions on redicemembers.com. When we return, we have Marion Van Court with us on dysgenics versus eugenics, another very enlightening show that goes against most of what I perceive you've heard already, and I hope you'll have some new things to think about after that show. We also have Joseph Atwill and Jerry Russell on Salinger's Catcher in the Rye. We have Mike Cross, Brian Anse Patrick, Brandon Martinez, Patrick Wood, Mike Campbell, and Mike Walsh. Please stay with us. Second hour with Daniel Spaulding is coming right up. Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen.